The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Was actually a precursor of what came to be known as the classical price and production theory, or the SRAFA school, what Fred calls the standard interpretation, to get into that. The problem is very simple. If, in order to argue that the inputs into the production process are constant, that they are constant and variable capital, and then for methodological reasons, and throughout the book, Fred argues that constant and variable capital do not change in the process of transformation, so that the prices of inputs, and I'll use the term inputs now to mean both physical inputs and the elements that go into making up the real wage that workers purchase with the money wage, that those things are not transformed, right, so that the inputs are constant, then Marx's story seems to work. Bortkiewicz's criticism was that Marx didn't transform the inputs. He failed to transform the inputs. Okay? Now, if you try to transform the inputs, if you do transform them, you can arrive at a consistent solution. No time to describe it. But it results in certain other anomalies, the most important of which are that certain fundamental equalities no longer hold. Those are the sum of surplus value being equal to the sum of profit, and the sum of value being equal to the sum of the prices of production. Total value equals total price, and total surplus value equals total profit. Those are the two that Marx emphasized. Actually, there are many more. I've counted about six equalities that you would want to maintain. But let's focus on just those two. And the rate of profit that Bortkiewicz derives from his equations is not the same as Marx's rate of profit. Marx derives the rate of profit by simply summing the total surplus value and dividing it by the total constant and variable capital. It's the macro aspect, determining the rate of profit first, and then that rate of profit is applied to determine the transfer of surplus value from industry to industry and the formation of prices of production. Okay, by critique. You can't say that, well, let me start this way. Let me say, what Fred does is he says the reason the means of production are not transformed, the reason there is no transformation of the inputs, and correctly so according to this interpretation, is that they are already prices of production, that the means of production already are in price of production terms. That transformation presumably has already taken place. We don't need to do it. We're looking at some other transformation. Now, if that transformation has actually occurred, if the means of production, the elements of constant and variable capital, are in price of production form, then there can be no further pooling and redistribution. The very fact that there is a pooling and redistribution of surplus value, which the Chapter 9 tables are describing, indicates that the inputs cannot have been at price of production originally. I tell in a paper I've just written, which some of the people have copies of, a long treatment of various different possible scenarios that arise out of this. The simplest one, you can try to figure out a way to argue that the five industries or sectors that Marx has in his tables are not constant and variable capital industries. They're something else. Well, are they luxury industries? Maybe. But then, you know, Marx is talking about the formation of the prices of production of luxury goods. I think his intention is much more general than that. Ultimately, you can't get by with any of this, and what you must assume is that the goods which are being, among the goods which are being represented by this pooling and distribution process are input goods. They are fundamental goods in the capitalist economy, wage goods and means of production goods. I'm trying to avoid the term capitalism. In the economy. If that is true, you're on the horns of a dilemma. You simply can't have it both ways. You can't say that the means of production are already prices of production, right? Prices of production have been formed here, but not here. But prices of production are in process of formation, which is what we set out to describe. Now, my view of this is not to say that Marx made an error, that Marx was wrong, you know. Bortnievich was an anti-Marxist. That's what he thought. It doesn't matter. Marxists have always learned from non-Marxists. Marx learned a lot from a lot of non-Marxists. What Marx did was illustrate a stage in a sequential process of transformation. And in that stage, it is correct to say the twin equalities are tautologies, you know, that at the moment when a transaction has been, when transaction has been made, you know, and inputs have been purchased, their prices are not going to change. There's not going to be any recontracting going on. You know, the input prices are constant at that moment, and then a pooling and redistribution occurs. But then prices change because the pooling and redistribution means a change in prices. And in a general approach to this problem, that has to mean a change in the elements of constant and variable capital. Then profit rates will once again be unequal, and there will need to be a further pooling and redistribution. At each one of these stages, Marx's metaphors, including the twin equalities, are perfectly valid. But they represent a stage in a process. And if you carry out, the mathematics are pretty well understood now. I think they call them ergodic matrices, convergent matrices. That a repeated application of this iterative process, as Anushek understood at one point, he did an article on this, Marx Vindicated article, and others. I worked on it also in the 1970s, but I never got anywhere with it, so I can't claim it. We now know, and Morishima worked on this, we now know that the end result, and I've done many simulations, is that the prices of production converge precisely on the standard interpretation prices, the simultaneous equation, Sraffa, Leontief, whatever you want to call it, model. Okay? Gotcha. I see. I'll just summarize my view. I'd be happy to send the paper to anyone who requests it. I'll send it out by, I'll send you an email. If you follow this to its logical conclusion, what you must, it seems, it's not a matter of interpretations. That's the point. It's not that saying, well, I have my interpretation and you have your interpretation. We can see which interpretation agrees the most with Marx's texts. I accept Marx's texts, you know. I don't think Marx made any fundamental errors, except perhaps for the error of having been mortal, of not having lived as long as we did, and into the time period that we live, and having been able to carry on the work that other people are carrying on, standing on his shoulders. The Sraffa equations depict the end point, you know, the prices of production, the final form of the prices of production which will emerge. And they do contain certain anomalies, if you want to put it that way. Certain things which we thought were true about twin equalities and other such things turn out not to be true. But I think we can live with that. I think it reveals the inner properties of the capitalist economy and our solid logical foundation upon which we can go forward. And I think if we don't have that kind of solid foundation, it gives non-Marxists an excuse to reject our project in total, including other things that don't have to do with the law of value. That's the way I would carry forward with our overall project.
Thank you very much. So, I'm Martha Campbell. I think that's enough to say. I handed out an outline. I sort of assumed there would be enough, but there probably aren't. There are some left. So this is pretty much what I'm going to say. As I understand Fred's book, and I may not be correct, I would say either, but the central theses of Fred's book are, first, that volume one of Capital explains the source of surplus value. And this is at the macro level. This is presented in its price form as the difference between M prime and M, or is it presented in its monetary form. This is also at the macro level corresponding to the total surplus value. Okay. It will turn out that in actuality, capitalists only buy constant capital at prices of production, but we don't know this yet in volume one of Capital. Fred's second major thesis, I think, is that it's only in volume three that Marx considers the distribution of the total surplus value among individual capitals. This, in Marx's work, this distinction between what is going on in volumes one and two versus what is going on in volume three, Marx calls the distinction between capital in general, which is the macro level, and then competition, which is concerned with the distribution of surplus value and the forms of surplus value as they're presented in volume three, interest, rent, commercial profit. Backtracking a moment, if you have my outline under point one, I argue, and I think this is absolutely true, in Marx's work, value is the explanatory principle, and it always appears in money. It cannot appear any other way except as money. This is the result of the argument of part one of Capital, volume one. Okay, so in volume one, there's the explanation of the total surplus value and its monetary form, M prime minus M. This accords with Marx's notion of science, which is that science doesn't make connections among phenomena. That's what vulgar economics does. Science explains phenomena by some underlying principle which is not itself phenomenal. So value is the explanatory principle of all the monetary variables. And so in volume one, total surplus value is the explanatory principle of M prime minus M. Coming back to my point two, it's only in volume three that Marx considers how total surplus value is distributed among individual capitals. I think this sequence from the macro level to the micro level comes out of Ricardo. It comes out of Ricardo's critique of Adam Smith. Okay? And you can't miss it in Ricardo. Ricardo says you have to have an explanation of a total before you can talk about the distribution of that total. Okay? So this is what's wrong with Smith's cost of production theory of price. When profits go up in Smith's version, the total could go up, or who knows? Ricardo is saying, no, you have to have the total such that it stays the same when one share of it increases. So it makes sense to me that Marx could have thought of this path from total to distribution. And for Marx, the issue is surplus value, total surplus value to distribution of surplus value. For Ricardo, it's total income versus distribution of income. But it doesn't really matter because this is a general principle that applies to anything. And Ricardo argues, if you consider labor as the source of value, then you have a way of explaining the total, which doesn't change when one share gets larger. Okay. I think the other thing that Marx understands from Ricardo is that Ricardo identifies the characteristics of individual capitals that cause let's see, I said it better, that cause surplus value to be distributed among them in the form of profit. So profit is a money form. Surplus value is the corresponding value form. Ricardo can identify the characteristics of individual capitals that make the surplus value different capitals produce different from the profits that they get. But for Ricardo, these are inexplicable contradictions to the principle of value. So Marx sees this in Ricardo. Marx calls them the composition of capital and turnover time. Ricardo calls it the ratio of fixed to circulating capital. But it, you know, so the concepts are transformed in Marx, but it's the same thing. So Marx sets out to solve this problem in Ricardo, and that also explains why he cannot present a theory of price in volume one. Because price, one of the influences on price is going to be the distribution of surplus value in the form of profit. Okay? So not only is volume one macro level, but it must be. So as I understand Fred's argument, prices cannot be defined until volume three. And they are defined as prices of production. So if we are reading volume three, we can look back at volume one and say, oh, I thought prices were proportional to values, but I see by the further development of Marx's argument that I was wrong. So what is happening in the argument of capital is that features of the system of capital, not to call it capitalism, I mean the same thing, features of the system of capital are being progressively defined as Marx moves from abstract to concrete. Okay. So the way I make sense of what Fred is saying, and if I have it correctly, I absolutely agree with it, is that it makes sense Ricardo could see these two issues in Ricardo and structure his own theory to handle them. And he, in effect, says as much in the contribution. It's one of his 4 points in the contribution at the end of chapter one. So the upshot of this is that the concept of price is defined in volume one, part one. Price is the money form of value. Beyond that, the magnitude of price is not defined in volume one. So I think the idea that there are prices in volume one is what I invented this name at the spur of the moment, a false concretization. That is taking something that is abstract, and instead of being patient and reading the rest of Capital, just fill it in right there as a price and hold on to that idea in spite of the development of the argument of Capital into volume three. Okay. So as Fred is arguing, there is no transformation of prices because there are no prices in volume one. So there is nothing to transform. So I think the two aggregates which the transformation problem tries to handle, okay, are simply tautologies that total prices of production equal total values is the money form of a value entity. Okay? That total profits are equal to the total surplus value, again, is the money form of a value entity. It's not a mathematical question. I think that there are two issues that I see in leading up to this great struggle over the transformation problem, these are two kinds of mistakes people make reading Marx. And you see them everywhere. Okay? One is what I've called false concretization, that is to say, this is hard, I'll try my best. Marx is moving from abstract to concrete. Okay? So the most abstract features come first. Okay? There is always a temptation to fill them in because you're reading, you're trying to make sense of this. Other examples of false concretization include, but this is not exhaustive, there are many examples, but one of the ones I find most irritating is the simple commodity production idea. Okay, the idea that part one, part one of Capital is about a whole economic system. No, part one of Capital is about simple commodity circulation, which is the surface of capitalist production. So to call it a different economic system is a false concretization. The other major mistake is that people miss the connection between value and money. Value does not appear ever except as money. Money is the phenomenon. Value is the underlying explanatory principle. Okay. So I would say the Sraffa system is really characteristics of production in general. I hate to call it the Sraffa system. Sraffa called his book a prelude to the critique of economic theory. So it's unfair to Sraffa, but it's really an input-output table with the that meets the conditions of simple reproduction. So what are called exchange ratios in the Sraffa system are not exchange ratios. They are the transfers of products that would be necessary to achieve simple reproduction. In Marx, exchange is what unifies private and independent production, and it is unified by the exchange of all products for money. The Sraffa system doesn't solve this problem, okay? Those so-called exchanges in the Sraffa system doesn't solve this problem. So if you are an anti-Marxist, you would say value is redundant. But really, what Marx is trying to explain is the specific social forms of production in the capitalist mode of production. And the Sraffa system, so-called being general characteristics of production, has nothing to do with this at all. This was the problem Marx found in the economic theory of his time, that it was general characteristics used to explain specific forms. And he tried to straighten that out. I know I should shut up. So for those of you who are sympathetic to Marx, why are you putting this thing in the middle of Marx's theory? Why are you putting general characteristics of production that all modes of production meet in some way or other? Why are you putting this in the middle of Marx, which is concerned exclusively with the specific social forms of production in capitalism, or the system of capital? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so my name is Jose Tapia, or Pepe Tapia, if you use the Spanish nickname for Jose. I am now teaching in Drexel University in Philadelphia. Let me start saying that I am not an expert on the labor theory of value. I study economics in the New School with Anwar Sheikh and Catherine Casanas, And there I started learning about the labor theory of value. And I must confess that since that time, that was about 20 few years ago, to the present, I have been puzzled. I have been puzzled because there are so many different interpretations, and the more I try to clarify myself, the more I get puzzled. So when I started learning about this, I learned from a person like Anwar Sheikh, that supposedly was an authority in these issues, that value is a quantity measured in time units. And therefore, since value is measured in time units, you can compute the profit rate in as a ratio of time units or as a ratio of money units, and they can give different ratios, of course. So then somebody told me that's a stupid idea. Value is always in Marx theory expressed in money, and I read and that makes perfect sense. But however, other times you read Capital and he's saying, well, if the value is 6 hours, C is 6 hours and S is 3 hours, then we have this rate of exploitation. So I continue my puzzlement. And then, well, to make the thing shorter, I just read the book by Fred. And I learned a lot from that book. I learned about the number of controversies and interpretations that I didn't know. And in a time I thought, well, Fred is clearly wrong in something. So I had his email, I had met him in some other meeting, and I emailed him saying, Fred, you are wrong in this and that. And he answered me, no, you are wrong because of this and that and that. And he was right. Clearly, he convinced me that my interpretation of prices of production, which was basically the cost price multiplied by one plus the rate of profit, was wrong, because the price of production is the cost price plus the average profit, which is the profit rate multiplied by the total size of capital advance that is not necessarily equal to the total cost. Anyway, so this is a subtlety that is not very important, but my general interpretation of the book is that it's a very useful book. It puts together a number of things that are dispersed, and as I said before, I learned a lot reading it. I believe much of what Fred says is very coherent. He exposed his ideas in a very clear and straightforward way, which is not something that is very common among authors in this context in we are. So in that sense, I believe it's a great book. Now, for me, the book poses a major issue, is why there are so many interpretations of Marx's labor theory of value. And I believe, of course, to answer this question is very difficult, but I believe that probably it would be fair to say that obviously Marx's theory is very different from mainstream economics. And the influence of thought coming from mainstream economics in the interpretation of Marx's theory probably is one of the causes, I am not sure if the main one, but probably is one of the causes producing these interpretations. For instance, in spite that I am esteemed puzzled, I increasingly believe that the idea that values are measured in time, well, is a kind of wrong interpretation. So increasingly, I believe a number of interpretations of Marx's theory of value are clearly at odds with a full and appropriate comprehension of Marx's theory. However, I think it's
quite difficult to deny that the presentation of Marx is open to interpretations. Marx presents his theory of value in the first chapter of Capital. Many people, I have a number of friends who have tried to read Capital, and they started reading after 3 or 4 chapters. They said, I cannot continue. And these are people who have read a lot of Marx and Engels, and the first chapters of Capital are very difficult. I believe one of the reasons of this is that Marx uses this Hegelian form of presentation. He uses terms like form and substance. And this opened the way to a number of different interpretations that we have seen in the past 150 years. Now, I believe that the key problem that Fred's book poses is precisely connected with the concept of value in Marx. So, for instance, citing concretely Fred's book, he says, the value of commodities in Marx's theory, quotation, is a complicated concept which has 3 interrelated aspects. The substance of value, abstract labor. The magnitude of value, socially necessarily labor time. And the necessary form of appearance of value, money and prices. Well, I believe this is a quite complicated animal. This is something quite complicated concept. Now, other people say that we have to interpret value in the system of Marx as a quantity of money which is an expression of abstract labor time. And concretely is, at least the way it's presented in volume 1 of Capital, is a quantity of money that is proportional to abstract labor time. That is the way. Now, that means that particular mathematical symbols that represent value quantities, for instance, in the famous C plus V plus S, as representing total value, these, for instance, C and V, if they are values, they are quantities of money that must be proportional to abstract labor time. But prices of production are quantities of money that are not necessarily proportional to abstract labor time. So the criticism that this C or this V in the general expression C plus V plus S cannot be at the same time prices of production and values, I believe, has some base. Fred is very good to present textual evidence in favor of his interpretation. And I read that, and I feel it convincing. But then I read other people who say differently, and it seems also convincing to me. So I must say that I am puzzled. I hate an intellectual attitude which consists in saying that you understand something when you don't. I believe, for instance, the so-called scientific literature is full of crappy papers that have been passed by reviewers who read the paper and were ashamed to say, I don't understand this. And therefore they said, oh, it's good. So the paper is published and it's crappy. Nobody understands what he or she said. But the paper is published and now it's... Well, I hate that. If I understand something, I understand it. But if not, I believe I must say I don't. So that is the issue. And, do I have time yet?
Yes, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, so
3 minutes.
a few important things that I believe are connected with all this. I believe the presentation of the labor theory of value in volume one of Capital is very curious, because in spite that time occupies a key position in the theory, there is no time frame for the theory. I mean, the profit rate in volume one is defined as S divided by the sum of C plus B, okay? But that's an absurd thing, because in a rate you need a time period. You cannot compute the rate of inflation for 1 month or for 1 year in the same way. They are different things. So in volume one, there is no time frame. Now, that is added a little bit in volume two and more in volume three, mostly by Engels, who wrote a whole chapter of volume three to fulfill to fill a hole there in the argument, which was precisely related to this lack of a time frame. Now we are not talking about a rate of profit in general, but an annual rate of profit, at the same time that we talk about an annual rate of surplus value, and so on and so forth. Then Marx says, well, different capitals have to have the same profit rate. And this is clearly an idealization. Marx is idealizing the capitalist system. Is something that is proper to do, but also implies that you are abstracting from reality. So the question of transformation is, to a large extent, pushed by the necessity to argue that different capitals get similar profit rates. In reality, it happens that empirical studies show that this is not right. In a given time, different capitals get different rates of profit, and it seems there is a general rule. The general rule is that the larger the capital, the larger the profit rate. So, I don't know. I think that this is part of the issue. And I am conscious that my presentation has been quite incoherent, but anyway, I am going to finish with one more thing that is perhaps related to the rest, is that I believe Marx presented his theory using a number of terms reflecting concepts that were completely new. I mean, the concept of surplus value, the concept of the rate of exploitation, the organic composition of capital are new concepts. And however, he used the concept of value that was used and had continuing, have been still used for 150 years more, and is now completely blurred. Nobody knows what he or she says when he used the term. And perhaps it would be good for people trying to develop all this system to write the presentation without using that term and using other
concepts.
Okay,
so thank you very much. We'll move on to our next presenter.
Okay, my name's Andy Higginbottom. I'm at Kingston University in London. And I welcome the opportunity to discuss Fred's book. I think it's a very fair survey of the debate in the literature. I think that's a service in and of itself, because it's quite a full literature. Secondly, I welcome sort of the manner in which Fred has approached this, the conduct of fairly sort of collegiate approach, which is often rare or absent, right? And thirdly, I welcome it because I think it puts old questions in a sort of a slightly new focus, and it shakes things up a little bit. And although I don't agree with some of the pieces that that are argued the particular thesis, I mean, nonetheless, it's welcome that a rather stale debate is freshened up in and of itself, because it's very important. So I want to make 4 points, and I'll probably concentrate, given the time, on just 2 of them. The 4 points that I would discuss in relation to Fred's book. The first is, what is the system logic of capital? And I don't
what
think
is it. So could you repeat?
Yeah, the first point is, what is the system logic of capital? And does it fit into
is it the systematic logic? What
no, I think I've said it fairly clearly. What is the system logic of capital?
The system
okay.
logic.
Yeah.
It's our American ears that hear about it.
Okay. I'm very sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. If I'm not speaking clearly, I should be more clear. Right, okay. The second area is that I would argue you need to read the chapter 9 in the context more explicitly in the flow of the argument in volume 3. Okay? In other words, it has a very definite purpose in relation to what comes before in volume 3 as well as what comes after in volume 3. And the third area of discussion, which I definitely do want to register, is that it's a transformation of surplus value into profit is not a pool of surplus value which is paid into and paid out of. This is not what Marx is looking at. It's not a problem of distribution. It's an issue of differential realization. Okay? It's a differential realization of surplus value into profit according to sector. Okay. And then the fourth area, if you won't have time, obviously, is a discussion about some of the limitations and pointers from the unfinished business, if you like, in Marx's approach. Okay, so I'm going to focus on the middle 2 points. In the immediate context of volume 3, what Marx first establishes is a state of disequilibrium, of necessary differential rates of profit formed at sector level. Okay. Now, one can sit down in one's study and work out what the average rate of profit is from that, but that's not the challenge. The challenge is, how does capital spontaneously, working as a system, achieve not an average rate of profit, but a general rate of profit? And Marx actually introduces a syllogism, which is clearly a Hegelian sort of construct, right? Which is that in order for surplus value to be converted into profit, it's not straightforward. You need a third element. And that third element is whatever the general rate of profit is. Okay. So in other words, the surplus value transformation into profit requires some concept of the totality in order to have a particular transformation. So this concept of the totality is present in the differential conversion. Okay? In other words, the total surplus value produced in a sector cannot be transformed into a total profit within that sector without taking into account the total profit of all workers for all capitals. Okay? That's the problem as he sets it up. Now, this is absolutely not the same as the departments of production problem. It's wrong, and it's a huge red herring and diversion. It's a completely different level of abstraction. Okay, the sectors of volume 3 are not sub-departments of volume 2. Right? You can think of loads of, I don't want to be falsely concrete here, but you can think of loads of examples, right, where that is the case. Okay, think of Ford trucks. Right? Are they a means of production or a means of consumption, right? They belong to a sector of production which is called vehicle manufacture, right? Which exists at a different level of abstraction, okay? So the question is not the movement of commodities and inputs and outputs. It's not an input-output question, right? The question is the movement of capital in and out of sectors according to the profitability of those sectors. And if anything is achieved by this discussion, from my point of view, that would be a plus, to refocus the discussion on the movement of capital. Okay. Now, if you think of what comes after Chapter 9 and in the rest of Volume 3, you can see that it's only after Chapter 9 that Marx begins to tell us how credit does move in and out of sectors, right? The movement of commercial credit, commercial crisis, banking crisis, and so on. Okay. So total social capital is posited ideally in chapter 9, but its actualization and the mechanisms of its movement are not revealed yet. I mean, they come later, okay? So what you have then is not, to repeat, not a redistribution of surplus value between sectors. It's as if there is a redistribution of surplus value between sectors. What you have is a movement of capital between sectors, okay? And the movement is essentially a movement of elements of money capital, of the total money capital, moving between sectors, okay? Now, Marx is also extremely explicit about this, and it's a point which is often overlooked. He has a national unit framework. He says it 2 or 3 times. All the capital in a country, okay? So what he's also got is an assumption of a common rate of surplus value, which you can argue to a greater or lesser extent holds, but it is not the total social capital in that sense. It's not the entire capital of a system, right? It's the total capital of a country in the system, and that's quite an important point when you come on to discussing some of the limitations given the necessary assumptions that Marx makes, okay? He's talking about, in other words, an aggregated national money capital, okay? And what he explains later is how a movement of, to some degree, banking, but in particular, stock market and so on, can move that money around between sectors, okay? Now, the key theoretical point that I want to get to is this question of not distribution of surplus value, but a differential transformation according to sector, okay? So as I've already said, there's not one pool. It's not like a floating escrow account in the sky where all these capitals pay in, right? And then they all take their bit out of it, right? It just doesn't happen like that. That is an idealization of what happens. What happens is that you have different rates of profit according to sectors, okay? And that means that there must be a different realization of surplus value by sector. Okay, so in other words, the surplus value which pre-exists as a category doesn't yield the same profit by sector. Okay, you have different profits according to sector in relation to the surplus value produced in that sector. Okay, so if that is true, then the melt solution melts away, by the way. You don't have a common conversion of surplus value into profit, right? There is no lambda, there's no one equation which explains it all. You can have a social average, okay, of the total surplus value and the total profit, but his whole point is that you don't have the same conversion by sector, right? The conversion has to be different, okay? I know, for example, the work of Simon Mohan, I'm not quite sure he fits into the schools, but I mean, he's just wrong, okay? There is not a lambda which sort of inverts the conversion of labour time into money, you know, the inverse of that, okay? Okay, so the surplus value produced in a sector is not the same as the profit realised in the sector, but rather it is conditioned by the general rate of profit. For a qualitative, this needs to be understood for a qualitative understanding of what's going on, right? So we know that Marx separates out different vantage points and different kinds of abstractions, right? What he does later on in Volume 3 is he puts this conceptualization to work. And the one area where he makes price of production work for its money, if you like, is in agriculture and rent, okay? He doesn't completely do it. I completely agree with Fred that we should think about Volume 1 on the basis of what we've understood from Volume 3, and it's very interesting to do that, right? In terms of, you can see, for example, in Marx's explanation of relative surplus value, he's already worked out price of production, but he's not going to say it. I mean, it's kind of like imminent there, right? Okay. But what he didn't do in relation to manufacturing industry and so on is explain how you then combine the level of abstraction of sector with individual capitals competing with each other, right? So you have, it's the price of production in Volume 3 is a sector price of production. It's the average price of production or the modal price of production for the sector, right? So individual capitals within that sector have to compete around that modal price of production. That's actually what they're competing around, okay? And he doesn't take it to that point in industry, but he does take it to that point in agriculture. In actual fact, right? And so what he's got is competing capitals in agriculture with the added complication, of course, of the differential fertility of the soil and so on, right? But it's very clear he's got these capitals competing on price of production, right? And it's also very clear what's happening there is that the surplus value that is realized by each of those competing capitals is produced by its own workers. It's a differential realization of surplus value. In other words, workers who are more productive because they're working on more fertile land for the same effort will create more value. It's like an enhanced labor. Okay, it's very similar to the enhanced labor of innovating industrial capitals. How much is that? 1 minute. Okay, right. So what I'm trying to say is that the category of price of production itself shouldn't be reified. It's a step on the way. Because what Marx does is he modifies value to price of production based on one variable, but there's a whole number of further variables, okay? And he begins to modify it further with the addition of absolute rent. There's a modified price of production in volume three, which adds on absolute rent to price of production, right? And there are other further necessary modifications to price of production. So the story has not ended yet.
Thank you very much.
Will you pass these out? Well, I want to thank, first of all, these esteemed commentators, distinguished commentators, for participating in this session, but even more importantly, for reading my book so seriously and engaging with the substantial issues. I also thank all of you for coming to the session. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I'm especially encouraged to see so many young people. You are the future, so take it from here. Okay, so I'm going to focus. By the way, the first page here is just an outline of. Very brief kind of topical outline of the main points in my book. If I had time or if I were presenting the book, I would kind of talk through this, but I don't have time, right? So I will try to touch on some of these points and perhaps we can raise them later. But you can see the macro, the two levels of abstraction, the production and distribution of surplus value. And the second point, just to mention that Marx's theory is about a single system. From beginning to end, right, from volume one, about the capitalist system, the actual capitalist system, and not a hypothetical value system as is often interpreted. Then the monetary aspect, the circuit of money capital, is the main point I want to emphasize and we'll come back to as the logical framework. This is not just a kind of side definition Marx makes in chapter 4, volume 1. This is presenting his method of analysis. And that has important implications. And it's very different from a Sraffian physical framework of input-output quantities, and that makes a huge difference. I argue that one implication of this MC dot 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 is that the M is the starting point of the theory, and therefore that provides the givens. The initial presuppositions in Marx explains the M at the beginning of the circuit in order, or assumes, presupposes the M at the beginning of the circuit, money advanced into circulation to purchase means of production and labor power, in order to explain delta M at the end of the process. So I'll come back to that. And the kind of critical point for the transformation problem is that the same quantities of M C, and V are presupposed in volume 1 and in volume 3. In volume 1 is the total magnitudes of constant capital for the and variable capital for the economy as a whole. In volume 3, that's disaggregated into the individual quantities advanced in each industry. I mean, I like to call the it's not really a transformation problem, it's a disaggregation problem. Moving from the total surplus value to the individual parts. And since it's the same actual quantities of money capital in both volumes, in all three volumes, there is no transformation problem. It's the same quantities of C and V throughout. So I will try to elaborate on that in a minute. The back page is just an algebraic summary. Which obviously we don't have time to go through, but I hope it might serve to kind of clarify the logic of what's the presuppositions and the macro and the micro, et cetera. And also, I hope, and I think the algebra does this very clearly, illustrates the fundamental differences between Marx's theory at the top and Sraffa's system of equations represented at the bottom. It's two entirely different logical methods. In Sraffa's theory, we can see from the equation. That's why I like to have the equation L there, labor, in that equation is only a cost, right? And there's no different between labor cost and material cost, PA, right? They're cost, right? So it has nothing to do with the labor theory of value, right? Labor as a producer of value. That key concept is expressed in Marx's theory up in equation 3, or the on the right-hand side, where the new value is determined by the labor produced. So I think it's a mistake to say to kind of try to combine or replace Marx's theory with Sraffa's theory. You're abandoning the labor theory of value, and necessarily so. I'm going to spend most of my time responding to David's comments, in part because David sent me his 36-page paper a week ago, and so I've had time to read and reflect. And so the third page there is notes, an outline of what I'm going to say in reply to David's critique that you, meaning I, can't have it both ways, right? That you can't both assume prices of production in volume one and then argue that there is a transformation from value to prices of production in volume three. Okay, so here's my reply to that. The main point, as he stressed today, of Lehman's critique, and my reply starts again with the circuit of money capital, right? As the logical framework of Marx's theory, as the main, it kind of expresses the main phenomenon that Marx's theory is trying to explain, right? How does a given quantity of money become more money, right? How do capitalists make money? That's the main thing about capitalism. So that's the main thing that a theory of capitalism should focus on, right? And that's precisely what Marx's theory focuses on, and the circuit of money capital provides that focus, right? And poses the main question in the theory. Then the second point I want to emphasize is that this circuit of money capital refers in principle to the actual capitalist economy, right? In chapter 4 of volume 1, right, the general formula for capital, right? This is not some hypothetical economy. This is the actual this is money advanced into capitalist into circulation in order to make more money. Right, and in principle, at least, obviously, you know, there's a lot of work to be done going from the abstract to the concrete. But in principle, Marx is talking about the actual capitalist economy from the beginning, and not a hypothetical value economy. I think this was, I would call, a false concretization, where you're kind of already talking about, you know, commodities, are talking about commodities exchanging at values. So that means that the delta M in the circuit of money capital refers to the actual total delta M in the economy as a whole, and the initial M also refers to the total actual money capital advance, in contrast to the usual interpretation where, because the standard interpretation assumes in volume one a hypothetical value economy, then that necessarily means that the M is a hypothetical quantity and the delta M is a hypothetical quantity. All of which, both of which, have to be transformed according to this interpretation in volume three, right? But if we start with the actual, right, then there's no transformation, right? There's going to be further explication, right? But there's no transformation of magnitudes, of quantities, right? So then I argue, as I mentioned before, that the initial M in the circuit of money capital is presupposed, is taken as given, as this existing at the beginning of the circuit, advanced into circulation, and in order to make more money, and is combined, the initial M presupposed is combined with the labor theory of value in order to explain the delta M. Right, the labor theory of value in production, new value produced by current labor, and a part of that is the surplus value. And this is an entirely valid and even common logical method, right, of assuming money cost as given. A long line of cost of production theories from Smith to Mill to Keynes and modern post-Keynesians take money cost as a presupposition in order usually to explain prices, and usually there's certainly the difference between Marx and Keynes and the cost of production theories is that Marx combines the initial cost with the labor theory of value in order to explain surplus value, whereas the cost of production theories either have no theory of profit at all or a weak and certainly a different theory. Right. Okay. So the M consists of these two components of constant capital and variable capital, number four, and it's assumed, I argue, since we're talking about the actual capitalist economy, in assumed to be in long-run equilibrium as an abstraction, that C and V are equal to. We're talking about the actual economy in long-run.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.